Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. Hi, everybody. Have you signed up to get regular news from 3 Minute Storyteller delivered right to your inbox? What are you waiting for? Go to 3MinuteStoryteller.com and subscribe today so you never miss a story. This week's storyteller is Lama Tulstrom Alayone. She's an author, an internationally acclaimed teacher, and the founder and spiritual director of Tara Mandala Retreat Center in Colorado. She's also the first Western woman to be ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist Lama. Our conversation meandered from sex as a path to liberation to the paradox of easing intense grief by taking on others' suffering, and even included an unexpected and beautiful guided meditation into the mandala practice that she writes about in her new book, Wisdom Rising, Journey into the Mandala of the Empowered Feminine. But I think what struck me most in our conversations were not just the answers she provided, but the questions she raised. I often think about our modern feminist movement as a struggle for equality, or I take a global lens and think about the fight for human rights and freedom from abuse and harassment. And all of this is incredibly critical, and we have so much work to do. But what was so evocative about this conversation with Lama Tulstrom was when she said, "I believe we don't know what it's like to live with the full potency of the feminine unconditioned by the patriarchy. What would it feel like to live without fear? How would it change both men and women and our relationship with nature and society itself, if the sacred feminine was fully realized? What would those qualities be? How would they look? And how would they transform our world if they were unleashed?" She reminded me that seeking bigger, more expansive questions can be so much more rewarding and lots more fun than chasing down the answers. Listened and read. I've heard you talk about your grandparents as a. Yeah. I just want to kind of ground us in the early parts of your story. Yeah, I haven't heard as much of your kind of spiritual upbringing, however you would describe that as a young child and with your parents.
I'm really a child of New England. My family is from there. My grandparents, my maternal grandparents are from there, and they were really the greatest influence in my life. And my parents, of course. So I was born in Maine, maniac. And then we moved to New Hampshire when I was 8. I was brought up as a Unitarian Universalist, which meant very liberal religious education, which also meant that there wasn't a whole thing I had to recover from in order to follow my path. Or I didn't feel like I was going against something. I had really religious freedom, but at the same time I did have a spiritual education in a sense. But it was more, I would say, humanist than religious. So when I was a child, I lived in New Hampshire, as I said, and I was very active and very much in nature and wildness. And I was a wild child. I rode horses, swimming, building things in the woods, barefoot all summer. My grandmother was a philosophy professor, the fifth woman to get a PhD from Harvard Radcliffe. And she had to get books out of the Harvard Library through male students because she was a woman. And so I think in a way the roots of my feminism go back to that and to her experience. She's a really wonderful person, very positive, very loving, great sense of humor. And she didn't get married until she was 35, which was considered over the hill in those days. And then didn't have my mother, who was the youngest of three daughters, until she was 40. So she was a kind of model for me of a wise woman in a way, because she was wise. And like my brother and I would be fighting and she would be laughing and saying, oh, isn't all this life wonderful? And then I went to college and I had been to Nigeria and other places in Africa between high school and college in that summer. And Africa was very important for me. The differentness of the culture and being with the Yoruba people and their talking drummers and their art and so on. And when I was in the beginning of my sophomore year, I had an out-of-body experience where I actually had the experience of leaving my body and floating up and being up at the level of the ceiling of the room. But real, like it didn't feel like it hadn't happened. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I'm imagining. It was like it was happening. And so when I was up there, I was like, oh, no, you know, this is scary. And I opened my eyes and then I was back in the bed. But it was enough of a real experience that it shook my world. And I ended up leaving college and going to India with my friend Vicky, whose father was a consul general in Calcutta. And it was through that experience with her and going there that I met the Tibetan people.
You know, in some ways your story is so much ahead of its time, because I think today about the rise of this large group of religious nuns. It feels like for the first time in history we have these, especially young people, but many people who are leaving the religious traditions of their ancestors or of their lineage and seeking something new. And many times that's often outside of any formal religious context. Mm-hmm. And you, you know, obviously went to Tibet, and you know the story is you became a Tibetan Lama, and. That's a pretty fantastic example of that process. Yeah. But I guess how I think of the world today is that we're in this middle place where we've sort of stepped away from what we know of rising up through an ancestral line of religion or faith, and we yet still have the longing for that community and that ritual mm-hmm. that our religion provided to us, mm-hmm. and we're kind of hungering and longing for that, but don't quite know where to find it. So I wonder if you could, maybe through the lens of sharing your story of how you became a nun, how you became a lama, and also through, I guess, your perspective as maybe one of the first that really did that mm-hmm. we know of in the West, mm-hmm. who tried on this. You know, how would you sort of begin to respond to that dynamic?
Yes, I think that's a good question of how we as Westerners are in this position of having left our family lineage religion and our spiritual, but haven't necessarily nested in something new. And so that leaves a lot of options open. And I think yoga has stepped into that, the popularity of yoga. And of course, yoga is practiced for some people as exercise, but it has its tracks back into a spiritual tradition. So that path of yoga has provided a gate for many people. For me, it was never really a question of my lineage. As soon as I found the Tibetan people and the Tibetan teachings, there was no going back. And I did periods in my life think, well, maybe I should explore something else. But I did, you know, I looked into the Native American tradition. I was interested in that and also into the Hindu tradition. But I just looked into it. I never really practiced it extensively because I had such deep karmic links with Tibet. And so for me, that was maybe a little easier than for some people who are seeking and maybe not finding their home. But what I would say to them is a great 13th century Tibetan teacher named Longchenpa. And Longchenpa said, be like a bee in the beginning and gather pollen from many flowers. And then at a certain point, you need to make honey. So then choose a lineage and really practice it. Because if you keep just picking up pollen here and there and never actually do something with it, you're kind of like a dilettante and your path doesn't begin. Or another analogy might be that Kala Rinpoche once said, it's like if you're trying to dig a hole and you keep starting different holes and digging a little bit, you're not going to really get anywhere. You just have all these shallow holes. So if you really want to do it, then stay and dig one.
I love how you wrote about Tibet. You described it as a laboratory for spiritual development. Mm-hmm. And it's so perfect. And, you know, being so protected on that plateau. Yeah. And isolated, you know, in a way, yeah, isolated from the world. And it allowed for the wisdom and the compassion to, you know, develop in it, in its very special way. You wrote something that said, if we change our spiritual paradigm, our society and culture will change. Mm-hmm. I just was wondering, like, clearly you're coming at this from a spiritual lens. Can you explain what you mean, mm-hmm, by that? Why, open, yeah, that up for us a little bit.
Yeah. Spiritual values are much more instrumental and behind our world situation than I think we usually give them credit for. The spiritual values of the patriarchy, patriarchal religions, which are basically all world religions, are all transcendent traditions, meaning the divine is seen as something outside this world, and that nature and women and what are called resources are to be used and potentially abused. But the spiritual, the ultimate is outside, is up, is out, is transcendent. And so that's created this split of spirit and matter in our values. And so we're not seeing nature as spirit, right? And we're not seeing women as spiritual. We're seeing women as an obstacle to the spiritual path, at least for monastics, male monks or priests or whatever. And so those values have created the desperate ecological system we're in and situation, and also the situation with women, the abuse, the control of women. Because historically, women have paralleled, the fate of women and the fate of nature has been parallel. And so I think that we have to shift that. And it's much more instrumental than we talk about. We talk about ecological problems and so on. We need to do something about the environment. But the environment is sacred. And so that splitting off of the spiritual from the earth, from the environment, has created a almost impossible situation that we're in now.
And as if it wasn't part of us too, as if we weren't, nature wasn't us too. You know, we're creatures.
Yes. Yeah, so what I suggest in my new book, Wisdom Rising, is that we have to shift that and we have to move into a model of immanence, immanent spirit, which means in the body and in this world that we're in now, that this is the divine. And this is what we worship, as well as our relationships with each other and our world. And stop thinking about the man in the sky. Or even if you don't have that specific image, that spiritual is up and out and that we need to escape from this to get there. Because until we start seeing this as path, this world as our path, this world as our spiritual path, and our senses and embodiment as sacred, we'll be in this sort of schizophrenic situation that we're in now. The split between spirit and matter.
I wanted to dig into your teachings around our masculine and our feminine sides, we're called to integrate. I'm just gonna read something that you just set up beautifully, that you wrote. You said, meeting our strong feminine energy, we will develop as women and not as women trying to be like men or asexual beings. We are different, and until that difference is known, owned, and maximized, our true feminine potency and capacity to bring this world into balance will not be realized. Mm-hmm. The powerful, fierce feminine is very much a part of the psyche, but it is repressed. And when it's not acknowledged because it's threatening, it can become subversive and negative. But when it is acknowledged, it's an incredible source of empowerment. So,
yes.
Enough said. That's it. That's everything. So I guess let me pause there. That's a lot. I don't know. Can you unpack that?
Well, one of the things that I say there is that until that difference is known and owned and maximized, we won't know our full potency. And so one of the things that I've seen in terms of feminism is that it's often about equality with men, which is important, you know, certainly in pay and the opening of opportunity and so on. And women have something different to offer, I believe. And we don't want to lose that. And in fact, do we even know what that is? Because it's been so distorted and defined by our society as it is now. And so what is the full potency of us as women? How are we different? That difference is important because it is different. And some of those differences, as I see it, are the feminine has a natural sense of interconnectedness, of relationship. It's known scientifically that women work with relationship and they build that web of relationship. So that's what ecological understanding is based on, is that we are interdependent. We are not codependent, but interdependent, and interdependence means that we're all connected. So that's one quality of the feminine. Another is compassion. This is something that's, of course, not unique to women, but women generally, if we generalize, have a natural sense of compassion and gentleness. And this is something that His Holiness the Dalai Lama talked about with his mother, that she was his teacher in terms of compassion. And my mother was too. Not that my father wasn't compassionate, but my mother was that one that taught me that empathetic concern for other beings. And also another thing that women naturally have is a sense of, if they're not being distorted by patriarchy, is a sense of the preciousness of life. And so a woman who's had a baby has carried that baby 9 months under her heart, given birth to it, usually not easily, and then cared for it. Of course, fathers are helping much more now, but still, it's still, at least in the beginning, goes back to the women a lot. And so she's going to be much less likely to send that child into war to be killed than the father. And again, I don't want to make it sound like fathers don't care about their children, but the involvement that she's had, the what she's put into that child is so significant. She will be less likely to send her child to war. And for example, in cultures like in the Iroquois Nation, which had a strong presence of the feminine and this idea of Mother Earth, they had a council of grandmothers who made decisions about going to war. They were the ones that decided. And so what if that was the case for us? So that would be what I would say would be the full potency of the feminine, that connectedness to nature as in a positive sense. Not that then they're not spiritual because they're like tied up with, you know, these natural processes of birth and so on, but that is the spiritual. And so that full potency of the feminine, these are a few thoughts and ideas I have, but I don't think that we even know what it is, because it's been so defined by and conditioned by patriarchy and rape culture and so on. You know, we don't know what it would be like to live without that fear and to be seen as equal from the beginning and having equal potency.
The for men and women alike, when the feminine and the qualities of the feminine are undervalued as they are, you know, it harms us both. Mm-hmm. And there's an impact mm-hmm. on every level of our being, on that, mm-hmm. particularly on our emotional makeup and what's allowed. So, you know, could you talk about that a little bit? How that undervaluing affects both of us, mm-hmm. all genders, yeah. the spectrum of gender.
Yes. Because we've lived in a dominator model culture, which means a culture of power over rather than power with, which has affected the racial situation and also the situation of gender in our world, it's also wounded the oppressor. And the oppressor, a lot of the oppressors don't really want to be oppressors, but they're also, that would be men, you know, in this sense. They don't want that role. But then, what's the role of the positive masculine in the future? And what's the feminine in the masculine? How would men be healed by the feminine coming into full potency? And so we don't want to just shift, you know, from one gender to the other. Now women are going to be the dominators. And that's never been the case, actually. I think that's the big fear of men, that, you know, if we're given equal voice, that we'll take over.
And of whiteness.
And what?
And of whiteness, yeah. versus people of color.
Yeah. If we allowed people of color, and if they were really equal, wouldn't they just take over and so on? So the men have been wounded by patriarchy also, and men are also perpetrators of it. And so the empowerment of the feminine within men is also important, for them to feel what that is. And if men don't have mothers or sisters who are in their full potency, they can't find that in themselves either. And it's wounded. And, you know, here we are sitting very close to the World Trade Center, remains of the World Trade Center, where it all happened in 9/11. And I haven't actually been here since that happened. I've been to New York, but not into this area. And it was actually a very important thing for me personally, because at the time of 9/11, I was in a solitary retreat for 1 year in Colorado, in a retreat cabin on the side of a mountain. And I was in meditation basically for 8 to 12 hours a day. And I was also there because I had been told by my teacher that I was too feminist, and that feminism, or, you know, the talking about the sacred feminines, emphasizing that was dualistic, and that was not truth somehow, not the absolute truth. And so I had been teaching, and was actually the only one that was of his students who was authorized to teach. And so there were process of exams that we were going through, and he said, you know, unless you stop this, don't come to the next exam. And so I wanted to decide what to do. This was a very, very important teacher for me, somebody who I had great respect for. And so I went into this retreat with that question: is this dualistic? Is this a spiritual obstacle that I'm hung up on somehow? And so when 9/11 happened, I was in my cabin. My husband came and told me. He normally would never come to my cabin, but he felt I should know. And so my reaction from where I sat there on the side of the mountain in Colorado was, where's the feminine in the lives of these men that did that? Where are the potent, sane, empowered women in the lives of those men? And also, where is that in the lives of the people that decided what we did, what the Americans did afterwards? And so that event of 9/11 actually was extremely important for me personally, because I made the decision on 9/11 that I had to embrace the feminine. I had to speak about this, that it wasn't just, wouldn't it be nice, but it was a matter of the survival of the species, the human species, that this happened. And so I came out of that. It was about maybe 4 months before I came out of that retreat. But once I came out, I made that statement. And it made it so I had to leave my teacher for some time. Luckily, that was healed, and about 14 years later he came and embraced Tara Mandala and everything that had happened. So that this issue of the feminine to me is extremely fundamental and extremely crucial in terms of what's happening in our world, and much more so than we talk about. We talk about Me Too, which is important, and we have, you know, the various male oligarchs being brought down by sexual scandal and so on, which is really important. And we need to see, okay, it's not just about women not being harassed. It's not just about moving out of rape culture. It's, what is the feminine? What are these qualities that they're so afraid of? What is this potency that women have that would change our world? And to me, when that shift happened was in the Women's March that happened in January of 17. And I saw this shift in women where they owned their fierceness, but they also owned their humor and their joy of being together and nonviolence. So although there was fierceness in that march and anger, righteous anger, there was no violence. And there was so much laughter and so much humor and joy. And so I think if men could realize that that's what it would be like, you know, we'd have a lot more fun. And there would be a different kind of presence. And right now, women are kind of like scratching their way up, you know, to be equal. And I think that's so important, and it's really important to understand that I'm not saying that's not important. And there's another piece of this that this book of mine, Wisdom Rising, is about. It's about this process of the need for empowering, I-N-powering, and the process of potentizing ourselves fully through the mandala of the five dakinis.
Can we go a little deeper into the layer of the women's wisdom? You know, you talk about women being keepers of wisdom and men being the guardians of this skillful means. Mm-hmm. And there's some great poetry that I won't read it, but you wrote about it so beautifully in your book. What does that mean? What does that construct look like? Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the potency of the intuitive feminine wisdom, like, explain that more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in Vajrayana Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism or esoteric Buddhism or tantric Buddhism, all those words mean the same thing. There's a lot of emphasis on the couple, the male and female couple or yabhyam, and they each have sort of potencies, and the potency of the feminine is wisdom, and the potency that's attributed to the masculine is skillful means. And so that doesn't mean that women don't have skillful means and men don't have wisdom, but the I guess you could say the primary energy of that is like that, the feminine holding the wisdom aspect. The way I experienced that personally was when we started Tara Mandala, which is this center that I started in Southwest Colorado near Pagosa Springs called Tara Mandala, 700 acre, very, very big project. And I worked with my husband. And I really saw how we worked in this wisdom and skillful means way, because I was meditating and having vision and ideas, and he was doing them. You know, he was actually overseeing the building. He was overseeing the office and so on. And, you know, there's certainly women that are very capable of doing, and men that are very capable of having ideas and meditating, resting in wisdom, and drawing on that wisdom energy. But what I felt was how I could have that energy of the vision and the wisdom, and then he was able to skillfully do it and facilitate it being done. And, you know, I think we have to be very careful always with these sort of stereotypical, you know, well, you know, you have to be this and you're this and, you know, those gender stereotypes. But I did really feel that it allowed me to enter more deeply into my wisdom, that he was able to do this, the other part. Because if I had had to do both those things, it would have been very difficult. And then he did pass away, and so I did have to do more of what he had been doing, but I never really did it all. Other people stepped in and so on. But that's a way to understand it.
Another aspect I wanted to talk about was sex. Mm-hmm. We never get to talk about that. I wrote about another quote you had written. There are stories of enlightened women practitioners in early Buddhism. We see a blossoming of women gurus in the presence of female Buddhas and Dakinis. These women taught the more intellectual monks in a very direct, juicy way by uniting spirituality with sexuality. And they taught based on using rather than renouncing the senses. So, I mean, I just think that's everything. So, can you talk about how sacred sexuality supports, you know, our journey to wholeness and enlightenment?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's happened in the West with Tantra is sexuality has been pulled out of it. And so when you say Tantra to people, they go, sex, you know, sacred sexuality, that's Tantra, but that's really not. Sacred sexuality is part of Tantra, and the image of Yab Yum is certainly fundamental to it. But what Tantra really is the embrace of the senses as path. And so it could be the sense of sight, for example. So now I'm looking at you, right? And if I can go into a non-dual experience and just experience you as you, and not me like thinking, oh, I wonder what, you know, is she married or does she have kids or, you know, what does she do when she's not here talking to me? And, you know, just all that. And if I just am with just sight, just seeing you and opening to that, and then we meet, we come into a non-dual relationship. If I'm with the sound that's outside the window, or, you know, the hum of the airplane as I'm on the plane, or the sound of a waterfall, and I enter into a non-dual experience with that, meaning there's no journey between me and the sound, or me and the taste if I'm eating something, then we have a spiritual experience right there. And so in sex, there's the potential for all those senses to be active and to be experiencing this state of non-duality, right? Because we have all the senses, and we have taste, we have touch, we have smell, and so on. Everything is there when we have sex. And so if we can activate all those all of our senses in that experience, we can really have a non-dual, a very potent non-dual experience, because it's all the senses happening at once. When what other human experience do we have that is so potent in terms of the senses than sex? And so that's why they say that sex is, it can be a path to liberation. But tantric Buddhism is so complex. That's what mandalas are from, deity yoga, other kinds of yogas, and so on. And so to think that tantra is sex is very, it's incorrect. And so in my book, I talk about, I distinguish between neo-tantra and tantra. But let's talk more about sex, because that's interesting. And it is interesting. And I had the experience with my husband of 22 years of marriage, and our sexual relationship got better and better and deeper that whole time. And so why? How? It wasn't technique, you know, or anything like that. It was recognizing that in that microcosm of our relationship was the whole universe. And the more deeply intimate we could be, the more we could know the cosmos. And so our experience and love, you know, that the deepening of love, the heart connection, the complete embrace of each other is healing. It heals that split that we have in our world, our dualistic split. And so to enter into a sexual encounter that has that level of intimacy and opening was extremely profound, and it kept getting deeper. And so there was no desire to go find someone else because it kept opening. It was kind of like a mandala, you know, where the more you look at it, the more it opens and you enter it. And that's what I would say to people, say, well, don't you get kind of bored after 20 years? I didn't get bored, and he didn't get bored either, because the connection was so deep. The reason we get bored is that we're not actually connecting. You know, that you can have a lot of sex without connection, without heart connection, and without actually being present, you know, caught in fantasies or even shopping lists or, you know, whatever, you know, like, or, you know, I just want to have an orgasm and go to sleep, you know. And so, and of course, you know, that's okay too. Like, it doesn't always have to be.
It's got a time and place.
Yeah. It doesn't always have to be extraordinary. But I think it's really interesting how it can keep opening and deepening. And of course, that takes work emotionally too, because if there's anger or there's secrets or there's holding back of resentments, you can't really get that level of intimacy and keep it. And so sex is integral. You know, we talk about sex as this thing, and it's being lived that way now with hookups and so on. Like, well, let's just have sex. And people have sex without having relationships. And that's more and more common, I think. But is that satisfying, actually? I don't think so. And I'm sad, because I think that this is, again, sex being defined by men. And men like the hookup. And women have always longed for that deeper related love connection. And so if women were defining sexuality and teaching it, and initiating their children, mothers were talking. I did this with mine. I talked to them about the potency of sex and the potential of depth connection through it. And I taught them what I knew. And my daughters didn't have sex until they were in college. And then, you know, I don't know exactly what their sexual experience is right now, but they have certainly felt its potency and importance, and without a lot of hang-ups about it, you know. So if we think of sex only in terms of the physical body, it's not that you can have an orgasm, and there's something nice about that, you know. Yeah, it's cool. And feels good, and then it's over in a few seconds. But if you connect with the subtle body, so we have our physical body, and then we have our subtle body, which is the chakra system in the body, and one of the main gateways to the subtle body is the eyes. So if you have sex in the dark, or with your eyes closed, the subtle bodies are not connecting, and so it's sort of like a 10% sex or something like that. Whereas if the subtle bodies are connecting, especially if the subtle bodies are trained and, you know, opened through practices, then the whole thing goes up to 100% connection.
To get back to the beginning part of our conversation, when, you know, I think others in our culture do long for more ritual and mm-hmm. more ways to honor life, you know, mm-hmm. or transitions or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I think of it almost like we don't quite remember what's lost, but we grieve that it's missing. And, mm-hmm. You know, somewhere you had written about how we've lost a lot of our centering rituals and dances and, you know, that the Tibetans carry through. But you know, the mandala practice is something that can help bring us back to our wholeness. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you would just explain a little bit about how you see that mm-hmm. unfolding and supporting us coming back from our fragmented separation of how we are within ourselves mm-hmm. and within each other and then within our relationship mm-hmm. to the earth.
The mandala is a template of wholeness. And it's a circle with four quadrants. When we place ourselves in a mandala meditation practice, we are in the center of that mandala. We are the deity in the center, and then there's at least four deities around in the four directions, and then Tibetan mandalas go way out into hundreds of deities and so on. But it's a healing of the fragmented psyche. The mandala heals the fragmented psyche because it brings it into the center, which mindfulness does also. But the difference between mindfulness and mandala practice is that in mandala practice, you're placing your mind in a symbolic structure. The intuitive mind, the unconscious mind, responds to symbols. And by learning the meaning of the mandala, for example, the deity of Dakini is in the case of my mandala practice that I'm presenting in the book, what they hold in their hands, their colors, the directions they face, and so on, is all symbolic. And so when you place your consciousness and focus on that meaning, it goes into a very deep level of our being, because symbols are very different than cognitive thinking knowledge. And so the mandala works with symbols, and it also works with color and sound, luminosity, and a circle with the quadrants. And so there's that practice of the mandala, which brings us into wholeness and keeps us there. And you don't have to, it doesn't necessarily have to be long. You could even a 10-minute mandala practice a day would shift your life. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to understand how your life is a mandala. And this is, in a way, what you were talking about of that longing for meaning in symbolism and a different kind of way of living with ritual and ceremony and so on. So if we see our world as mandala, and for example, you're in the middle of your mandala, you have your husband, your family, your friends, and so on. And so if you take a moment, let's just take a moment now and feel yourself in those relationships, but you're in the center of it, and that those are your mandala around you. And they're all present and in some way holding you, and you're holding them. If you allow yourself to enter into that experience of your world as mandala, you immediately feel a fullness, a centeredness. You're surrounded by that love, that potency, and all those activities. So if we see them, see your mandala as your retinue, you're the goddess, you're the Dakini in the middle, and this is your retinue. That's very different than thinking, I'm married and I've got to go get my kids at school and I've got to, my husband. And so your life is just this go, 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 do, but you're not landing in it in that centered way. And then if you think of your greater community as a mandala also, and that's still you, you're still in the center, but then there's the greater community that's part of your mandala too, and in your work. Here, what you're doing with me, that's also part of your mandala. And so there's a different kind of feeling that you have when you're experiencing your world as a mandala than if you're experiencing your world as some linear, you know, process that's going from birth to death, and you're somewhere on that, on the, you know, middle of that path, although you never know really where you are because you don't know when you're going to die. So instead of that, if you feel yourself settled and in the middle of something that's whole already and not something you need to fix or that is lacking something, but it's complete just as it is. So let's take a minute and just feel that. Do you feel yourself settling? Mm-hmm. That's the outer mandala. There's nowhere to go. It's already complete. And those, the retinue is feeding into the center. The center is offering out to the retinue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can feel the
it's encircling you. It's whole. Maybe you have teachers, your teachers are in your mandala, or maybe you're in their mandala somehow. So these interlocking mandalas where you're maybe in the retinue of another mandala, but you're always in the center of your mandala. And so that's a different thing than being egocentric or everything is about me. You know, I'm the most important thing. It's transforming that egoic fixation into an experience of trust. Trust, and the ego's never trust. It's always feels insecure and needs to try to establish itself, and it never can because we are based on emptiness. And so as much as we try to like solidify things and make them solid, it doesn't work because everything's changing and everything's made out of partless particles. And you know, when we break it all down, it's not solid. So if we can rest in the reality of that and feel ourselves in the center of our mandala, that's very liberating from that sense of insecurity.
There's a deep sense of the interconnection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you, like you were describing, you could feel the flow.
Mm-hmm.
I think intellectualize it, it could feel ego.
Mm-hmm.
But when you feel it,
mm-hmm.
you feel how it's in relationship
mm-hmm.
to the whole.
Mm-hmm.
Not like
mm-hmm.
you said. And you have to, I think, enter into it to really understand that nuance.
Yeah.
You know, I think about your life and your history, and you've endured some of the worst suffering imaginable with the loss of your daughter, and you mentioned that a sudden passing of your beloved husband, and you've had abuse and divorce and
mm-hmm.
postpartum depression and a lot of uniquely female suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Your life journey had you experience suffering in the most intimate way possible. You had to know it from the inside out. And I'm thinking of your work in helping us, you know, remember and awaken this female, you know, divine, and how you had to understand the conditions of pain, or you did. You understand it because you lived it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder. How do you make sense of that in your own personal kind of history and reality to the work
suffering
that you're called to do?
I've
yeah,
had.
The women's suffering that you.
Yeah. You know, I was a nun and didn't have children. And once I did, I, of course, thought about this, like, well, what if I'd stayed a nun? And, you know, what has this given me? And I felt it had given me empathy. When I was a nun, I would see like women with children. I would be kind of like, oh God, they're just, you know, so taken up by that, and being kind of, their lives are just being consumed by it. Once I had children and I had moved from being a monastic into being a nun, I mean, from being a monastic into being a a lay practitioner, I was never just a lay person because I never stopped practicing as my main thing. But in any case, I felt it gave me patience, humility, empathy, all kinds of things that maybe I would have had as a nun, but I think it was like a crash course. A crash course in the patience, for example, and tested me in ways that I wouldn't have been tested. And then losing a child, having a child die at 2.5 months of sudden infant death, every mother's worst nightmare to find your baby dead in the morning. Then again, I felt connected to all the women in the world who had lost babies and lost many babies, many more than me in less affluent countries. And so again, this real empathy. And the same thing when my husband died. What actually helped me was a practice called Tonglen. And Tonglen means taking and sending. But I did Tonglen with that specific suffering. And so when I thought about it, there's a song that we sing called Taking Happiness and Suffering Onto the Path. And so one of the lines is when I suffer, I'm happy because I can take on the suffering of all beings. And I was singing that one day after Dave died, and I thought, I can't take any more suffering. I die. I break. But then I thought, well, maybe you wouldn't. And so I did it. I practiced breathing in all the suffering of all the women who had lost their beloved, like me. And it was very paradoxically freeing, because I realized that it made me bigger. Grief, I felt very contracted. It was like a pressure cooker day and night. And by opening to the suffering of others, of other women, particularly, and that's what I focused on first, was just other women. And I was like, well, it brought up that empathetic connection, and it brought me out of that compression. So it actually helped my grief. I wasn't doing it for that purpose, but I was really, you know, it was experiential. I was like, wow, that like took some of this away. And then I expanded it, you know, to all the people who were lost, their beloved men and women, and then also all beings suffering, gradually move it out and hold all that. And the more I held, which seemed impossible, that I could take any more, the more I felt relief, because it was that connectedness and moving out of the self-focus into empathetic connection, which helped me. Very odd. And so I would never have learned that. I would never have learned about grief. Now, if somebody says to me, I lost my husband, I don't just say, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, oh my God. You know, I get it. I understand so much more what that means now. And therefore, I can be more with her. And if somebody lost a child, or all this suffering that I've been through, also hasn't made me unable to feel joy. And I think about Tara, you know, the Buddhist goddess, Buddha, she's a female Buddha. Tara, she's savior's suffering, and she's smiling. And so not losing that humor and the smile doesn't mean that you're not feeling suffering or empathetic response to others. It's a joy that comes up that can be there with that. And I see this in His Holiness the Dalai Lama, whose people lost everything. He lost his country. He's a refugee for so many years now. But he has the most amazing sense of humor, and he's so joyful. And so it's important not to turn away from suffering and kind of be in denial, to witness it, but also to be able to do that and keep Tara smiling.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about Lama Alione, including her teaching schedule, visit taramandala.org. To learn more about the Sacred Feminine and to find out about her incredibly transformative new book, including her upcoming book tour dates, go to wisdomrisingbook.com.